Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh yeah, started to burn too many things we found. That's the Divine Dar Williams sing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song. We're back for another Green Power and Wellness Hour. We're down to the wire here. We've got a great show for you. We're going to talk about public banking, Mark Armstrong and Ellen Brown. Are you guys with us?
Yep,
yes, we are.
I'm here. This is Ellen.
Okay, both of you. And we also have the great Joel Siegel from North Carolina. Joel, are you with us? Joel Siegel, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
Hi,
you are. Okay.
Survived the climate change-induced hurricane here. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. We got another. Well, one thing that's happening. Well, here's the show today, folks. We are going to talk in great detail with Mark and Ellen about public banking. There is a very important ballot initiative here in Los Angeles that we want to go through the detail. We want to talk about shifting the power of our banking system away from private corporatist hands into the public. It's a very, very big deal, and I'm honored to have Mark and Ellen on with us to do that. But before we get to that, we are going to spend about 15 minutes or so with the great Joel Siegel in North Carolina, who told me something. And Mark and Ellen, this is going to be about voter suppression, and you're more than welcome to jump in anytime you are inclined. But I want to say that, you know, we are looking a month away, barely, at a potential total fascist takeover of the United States. I'm believing, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, that if the Republicans hold control of the House of Representatives for the next 2 years, I'm not sure that anything resembling democracy is going to emerge from two more years of this Trumpist extreme right-wing fascist takeover. And so it's very clear to me that the nature of the election, especially as it involves the House of Representatives and, of course, the Senate and numerous governors' mansions around the country, is going to depend on voter turnout, which in turn is depending on the ability of the Trumpists. It's no longer really the Republican Party. It's the Trumpist Party. It's going to depend on their ability to suppress the ability of people to vote. For example, in Georgia, we have a governor's race where the Secretary of State, the incumbent Secretary of State, is running for governor. He is controlled against Stacey Adams, the first black female nominee for a governorship in Georgia. I think even in the United States, actually. I don't think we've had a black female governor in this country. But at any rate, this Secretary of State, now running for governor, is sitting on more than 50,000 voter registration forms, nearly all of which are from African Americans. In Ohio, we have the Secretary of State, John Houston, running for lieutenant governor with Mike DeWine, and he has purged more than 1 million voters from the 5.5 million in Ohio. And, of course, these, again, are virtually all African Americans. In North Dakota, we have a Senate race where Heidi Heitkamp, the incumbent Democrat, is running against basically a Trumpist right-wing candidate for the Senate seat, which is crucial, of course. We're talking about the U.S. Senate here. And the courts have just ruled, the Supreme Court has just rolled over and is allowing the Secretary of State in North Dakota to completely disenfranchise virtually every indigenous citizen in North Dakota, because tens of thousands of the North Dakota indigenous live on reservations, And for the first time, they're now demanding, you know, completely arbitrary, they're demanding a street address in order to have a valid voter registration form, even though they know full well, or because they know full well, that most Native, nearly all Native Americans, indigenous people in North Dakota have post boxes, because you don't have street addresses on most reservations. And the Supreme Court has refused to overturn this ruling. And that virtually guarantees that the U.S. Senate seat in North Dakota will flip from the Democrats to the Republicans. And this is going on all over the country. Now, Joel Siegel, I talked to you earlier today. You told me that you called the Democratic National Committee about this. Can you tell us what the Democratic National Committee had to say about what they're doing about voter suppression?
They said very little. You know, thank you for years of being a leader on anti-voter suppression efforts, Harvey. You and Bob Fotrakis and Greg Palast and Ari Berman, Barbara Onwine, people who are my teachers when I work for John Conyers. And it reminds me of Ohio 2004 when the vote got stolen and people found hundreds, if not thousands, of provisional ballots and ballots in trash cans. This time around, I'm going to give you a shocking figure, 30 million to 80 million people will be voter suppressed in one of the world's greatest so-called democracies. That's from the Voting Rights Caucus, Transformative Justice Coalition, which you're on the board of. I called the DNC to ask them, what is your plan to combat voter suppression? They said, well, we have a hotline. And I said, well, no one knows about the hotline. And what I realize is here we have the greatest voter purge, cross-check, closing down early voting sites, and many, many, many more. Your listeners, if they go to votingrightsalliance.org, they'll see through the Transformative Justice Coalition website the 36 or 37 ways that where Republicans will be suppressing the vote. And there isn't a need for an emergency ad hoc committee to stop voter suppression, and that's what Barbara Onwine and myself and many others are going to be putting together starting tomorrow. But the states we have to be concerned about are North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Kansas, Arizona, Texas, I'm going to go fast, Alabama, Missouri, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, New Jersey, North Dakota, and Iowa. And I'll close by saying most elections are won by 1% or 2%. If we cannot be look through rose-colored glasses anymore and go, oh, we're going to take back the House and the Senate, the Democrats, I say before you make that prediction, ask yourself, if 30 to 80 million people can't vote, what does that mean in terms of stopping fascism, Trump, and the right-wing Republicans? So this is very serious, but there's no united front or strategy to combat this, and that's what we want. We have got to turn that around, not only now, but in subsequent elections until the Voting Rights Act is restored, which was gutted by the Shelby case.
Well, it's astounding to me that we have an alleged Democratic Party in this country, and they're not doing anything about this. I mean,
I've been in the Democratic Party since for 37 years, worked in Congress for 13, used to run congressional campaigns, and right now they're raising their money for their campaign commercials and trying to show that they're really against Nancy Pelosi like they do in North Carolina. And they have no strategy whatsoever. However, the good news is we are now working with them to come up with a strategy. There is a conference in Alabama next week where there'll be about 700 African-American activists from 7 to 8 southern states who will be convening to come up with a strategy. Barbara Onwine will be there, and that's going to be convened, by a organization that does voting rights protection. It's a little bit late. It's just a few weeks out. It's better late than never. But if you live in Los Angeles and you say, well, or California, what does that have to do with me? It has to do everything with you. If you want single-payer Medicare for all, 100% clean renewable energy, if you want to stop climate change, you've got to be concerned about the votes in other states.
Absolutely. And it's almost incomprehensible that, here we have this fascist in the White House. We have a Democratic Party that never, ever refrains from attacking people on the left. You know, they're still blaming Ralph Nader for the 2000 election, and Hillary Clinton, who walked away from the Sandinista movement, which mobilized more than 10 million, mostly young people, and she did her very best to alienate that. She still won the election by 3 million votes, and she walked away and did nothing about voter suppression. We have not heard a peep from Al Gore, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton about abolishing the Electoral College, which should have been done, which is the only reason Trump is in the White House. And now they're a month out, knowing what we've known about the 50,000 people that were stripped from the voter rolls in Florida 2000, about the more than a million that were stripped in Ohio in 2004, and have been stripped throughout 2016, and the Democratic Party still has no strategy to deal with this. I mean, how crazy is this?
It's beyond crazy. I think it shows the pressing need for newer leaders, younger leaders, leaders of color, people who may not have been involved in politics. If you don't want your country stolen by the KKK, the skinheads, the far right wing who now are in the White House, I posit that Donald Trump is the new imperial wizard of the KKK. But he's very powerful because the new Republican Party is the party of Trump, as you said earlier. We're going to have to, I think, do two things. We're going to have a, I've been saying this for about 26 years now, a united front that's progressive, and we got to get out of our silos and these foundation-granted NGOs that I think are creating a big problem. But as a true progressive, if we don't create a united front, at least now, on voter suppression and get out the vote, we will continue to see these Republican victories. It's not just Congress. It's the General Assemblies. Like where I live in North Carolina, they just put a moratorium on wind energy a year ago. We can't use wind energy in Charlotte. Yeah. These voter ID, they're closing down in the African-American community, Harvey. They're closing down the early voting sites. In Alabama, if you remember, they closed down the DMV, in African-American Department of Motor Vehicles, so blacks, you know, couldn't get their IDs. So there's millions of people who do not have access to voter ID or a passport, and that's what they have to have. And if you're disabled, God help you, physically challenged, that's 3 million people. There's no accessibility for them. And why there has not been a response to this, I don't know. I'm very proud of Barbara Onwine and the Transformative Justice Coalition, the TJC. Their website, votingrightsalliance.org, is where you can get all the salient information about voter suppression. And if you go to vote.org, you can check to see whether or not you're registered. So if you're listening right now, and if you're not sure whether you've been purged, let's say you didn't vote in the last two elections. The Supreme Court has given the states the permission to just take you right off the voting rolls. If they sent you a card asking for your address and you didn't answer it, they can also take you off your voting rolls. If there's a Harvey Wasserman in Wisconsin, they can say, oh, you know, there's two Harvey Wassermans, and then we're going to take the one in L.A. off who has that radical commie radio show. You know, I mean, that's cross-checking. And it's, you know, a lot of the organizations who are working on this don't have the funding that they need to get their message out and hire a PR firm. But, you know, that doesn't matter. We're going to have to do it now. And I hope some of your listeners, if you're listening, you can call me at 571-344-1518 if you want to be part of this emergency anti-voter suppression working group. Then please call me. And we need Greg Palast involved, and you, Harvey. We need an article written ASAP. And once that article is written about what's going to happen with the purges and voter suppression, we'll get that out to the DNC immediately and all over folks so we can people have to understand the facts first. They don't understand the problem. I think that's the biggest issue.
Ellen Brown, you're out here. Are you in Los Angeles? Where are you now, Ellen Brown?
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles. Well,
Mark Armstrong, you're in Virginia?
No, Santa Clara. Oh, right.
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles as well.
Oh, you are? All right. So we're on the left coast here. Do either of you have anything to add about this discussion on voter suppression?
Please, not from me.
I did see the article this morning about the about North Dakota and how this was
almost a third of the country
disenfranchise Native Americans.
We're not. You know, we need a response from
really
everybody.
But
I'd love
Joel, hold on. Let me come back to you for in a minute, Joel. Mark, go ahead.
I was just saying that in North Dakota, I saw the article, and it's quite unfortunate that such a large percentage of the population of Native Americans will be disenfranchised. I'm not sure if they were going to be voting I'm not sure how they were going to be voting, but that's unfortunate.
Well, it's very clear from the last election when Heidi Heitkamp was elected in 2010 2012, that she got in because of support from the Native American community. And now those
really?
People are pretty much not going to be allowed to vote. And I want to announce I'm going to definitely be a poll worker on Election Day somewhere here in Los Angeles. And I hope that everybody listening understands it's not enough just to vote. You cannot just vote and think it's going to solve the problem. You got to be a poll worker. You got to help people get to the polls. We got to work on making sure that the people who are registered to vote are actually able to come out. That they, if they get, you know, avoid getting provisional ballots if at all possible. Ellen Brown, do you have anything to add on this?
No, I only became aware of that just now myself. So, but I agree.
Okay.
It's too bad.
All right, Joel Siegel, I interrupted you. You were talking about how many people are being subjected to voter suppression.
No, I apologize. I actually...
No, it's all right. Go ahead.
Sorry. My bad. Between 30 million and 80 million are the projections from the Voting Rights Caucus, which Barbara Onwine and I are co-founders of. Their recent number is 80 million. And it really makes sense because the far right wing has been working on this since 2004, but the response is, as long as we have an increase in black people and brown people and students who are voting increasingly Democratic, Republicans cannot win their races, even if they're gerrymandered states, unless they suppress the vote. But I remember when Jimmy Carter used to go down to Nicaragua and he would go down to Panama in order to make sure, you know, that we had a fair there was a fair vote down there. You know, perhaps Jimmy Carter and Obama and Clinton and George, you know, W. Bush, perhaps they need to come to these states that I referenced and see whether or not we can vote. I really think we're going to need to have maybe the United Nations. I'm dead serious. I think the United Nations needs to intervene and bring people from the UN to the states where there's voter suppression, because Jim Crow is alive and well here in North Carolina and all these other states in the South, and we need international poll watchers. And yes, we need people to work the polls, but I think we need intervention from all over the world to come here, and we need members of Congress and state legislators, students. We need everybody to come to these states and make sure that our 30 million to 80 million people are not allowed to vote, all because the Supreme Court overturned the 1965 Civil Rights Act. That's the ultimate goal, is the restoration of the Voting Rights Act. That, you know, how many people bled and died for passage of that? And then the Supreme Court just said, well, we'll overturn it. So the states used to have what's called preclearance. If they were going to restrict the vote, they had to get a clearance through the Department of Justice. They no longer have to do this anymore. Most people, Harvey, I guarantee you that most of your listeners are not aware that the 65 Civil Rights Act for voting no longer is in effect. I don't think they know.
Yeah, it's outrageous. And of course, the selective disenfranchisement of voters is what put George W. Bush into the White House. It had nothing to do with Ralph Nader. If Ralph Nader had not run for president in 2000, George W. Bush still would have been put in the White House by his brother Jeb in Florida. The voter suppression gave Bush a second term in 2004, and it put Donald Trump in the White House in 2016. And I'm going to Tony, the three people most responsible for Donald Trump being in the White House are Al Gore, John Kerry, and Hillary Clinton, none of whom have come forward to help with this fight to make sure that people can vote. They're all just sort of pontificating with emails and stuff like that. I got to say also, I get, like you, Mark, and Ellen, and Joel, you know, I get an endless stream every day, 6 to 20 emails from various Democratic candidates asking for money. Not one of them has mentioned voter suppression. Not one of them has asked me to become a poll worker. Not one of them has talked anything about the theft of these elections in prior years. And, you know, the reason that Donald Trump is as powerful as he is because we don't have an opposition party. Who can tell us who is the leader of the Democratic Party? Who is out there that people can rally around? What does the Democratic Party stand for? Anybody got any answers to any of those questions? No.
Oh, I can take a stab at it.
Yeah, go ahead.
The Democratic Party, in its current form, does not stand for anything except preserving the great society of Lyndon Johnson, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, you know, New Deal. And then because of the leadership of the Black Caucus and Progressive Caucus, we almost got Medicare for All passed. I was there and you know, one of the lead staffers on that. And we got the Affordable Care Act, which is, you know, still completely inadequate. And that's why, you know, Bernie Sanders, that wing of the Democratic Party, has got to take over. So progressives have to take over the city councils, the state legislators, and members of Congress have to run who are progressives. I'm sorry, my electricity just went out because of the hurricane here that was induced by the burning fuels.
Oh, my God. Wow. Okay, so one last thing.
In fact, the two of the most important Democratic candidates running for Congress and where I live, the first thing they said in the debate last night was, the first thing we want to do is get Pelosi out, and we want to vote against Pelosi. But Democrats need to run on a Bernie Sanders platform. Medicare for all, jobs for all, you know, free college tuition. They're running far away from their base, not towards it. And unless we take over the Democratic Party precinct by precinct, like we're doing in Charlotte, North Carolina, it's not going to change. So we can't just criticize. I'm not pointing you out at all, Harvey, but we're going to have to go into these Democratic Party meetings and take them over. There's only two parties. John Conyers used to say this, Representative Conyers. There's the Republican and there's the Democratic Party. Should there be a third party? Absolutely. I wish I lived in Europe, but I live here. We have to take over the Democratic Party and move it as far left as we can. And we can do that, but we can't do it just by blogging about it. We have to go into the meetings and start organizing and just take over the party. The Tea Party took over the Republican Party. Why can't Bernie-crats take over the Democratic Party? And Ralph Nader.
Ellen Brown or Mark Armstrong, do you want to say anything about that?
Not me.
No.
Ellen? Okay, so here we go.
I'm sorry, but I can't really hear the discussion very well.
Okay, well, are you hearing all right, Mark?
No, it's very difficult to hear. I can hear you fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, well, you're having a hard time hearing Joel. Okay,
I'm on a landline, by the way, but there is a hurricane. Okay. That might have something to do with it.
Yeah, well, I can hear you. Okay, so, one last thing. I have to mention this before we get into public banking here. This election in so-called election in Brazil is deeply disturbing. What has happened in Brazil is that the front-running candidate, Lula, who is a progressive and stands for, you know, a lot of good small-D democratic reforms, was put in jail. And before the election, and the courts there in Brazil are not allowing him to speak at all to the media. And what's coming now is that this guy is a real fascist. I mean, you know, we can throw the term fascist around. This guy is a murderer, and whatever his name is. And so when we hear, and the only reason if he's leading is because Lula is in prison. And when we hear Donald Trump you know, throwing off these lines like "lock her up." This is not easily dismissed. What he's doing is setting the groundwork for the idea of himself as in the White House with the control of the court system of putting opposition candidates in prison. And I know that we Americans who've glided along all these years without such a possibility are now going to have to face the reality that, you know, when he talks about locking up Hillary Clinton or Dianne Feinstein, that needs to be taken seriously, because we could look at an election in 2020 where he would actually lock up the opposition candidate. And I'm going to leave it at that. Joel, you're welcome to stick with us. We're going to switch now into a discussion of public banking. I want to thank Ellen Brown and Mark Armstrong for your patience here. Joel, I know you know something about this, but they're having trouble hearing you. But if you can speak up, let's do it. So let's segue into this discussion of public banking. And Joel, if you've lost your electricity, I don't know, maybe you got to evacuate. I hope you're okay where you are. And good luck on another global warmed hurricane here. But yesterday, the stock market plummeted 800 points, and it's kind of wobbling around today. I don't know if this is going to affect the election.
It's down 550.
Another 550. So here's the question, Mark Armstrong and Ellen Brown, and Joel, you're welcome to chime in. Is this the end of the big run of the stock market? Even though, you know, $1.5 trillion in stock in tax breaks were given, and another God knows how much just a few weeks ago by the Trumpists. Is this the end? And what does public banking now become a more viable alternative?
Well, yes,
Ellen, you
I
can
would
answer
say
that
it's
one.
The end of the bull run, and it's because the Fed is raising interest rates, which puts businesses further in debt. It's going to drive a number of businesses out of business. It puts everybody more heavily in debt, particularly if you have a variable rate mortgage. But just for people that are considering buying a new home, et cetera, they may not be able to do it now that interest rates are going up to like 5% on home mortgages, which is high compared to where they have been. So, and in other countries, of course, they're having even worse troubles with debt. So the Federal Reserve knows that. I mean, they always, whenever they raise rates, it creates a recession or a depression. But they're doing it anyway for unknown reasons, and even the president is criticizing him for that. So, yep, I would say
well, of course,
the top, and we're heading down.
I'm sure that Trump is really freaked out. If anything can freak out Donald Trump. And by the way, Joel Siegel, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay, if we lose you because of the hurricane, will you please tell people how to get a hold of you and your voter suppression work, just in case?
Sure. To get a hold of me, call me directly on my phone, 571-344-1518.
All right, Joel Siegel, 571-344-1518. If we lose you, we'll understand it, but you're welcome to stay with us anyway. And don't jeopardize yourself on that landline if the hurricane's coming at you.
Okay. We're good. We're good. It's looking better now.
All right, let's hope. All right, well, Ellen Brown, you know, I'm surprised that Trump hasn't taken the Fed out and you know, gunned them all down for raising interest rates just prior to an election. I mean, this is pretty amazing timing, don't you think?
Yes. Well, it's not clear who's, I mean, it, yes, it's interesting, very interesting.
Mark Armstrong, what do you think about
I mean, it's a huge mistake, if you ask me. I think the Federal Reserve should be buying federal debt, not selling it. But they think they're normalizing things because supposedly the market is back where it's supposed to be. But they're only looking at they consider the stock market the gauge of how the economy's doing. And they're not looking at the bottom 80% of the economy where people are still struggling to get jobs. We've got a massive homeless problem. People can't afford homes. And nobody's getting a raise. If supposedly the reason for raising interest rates when you get near full employment. They allege it's near full employment, but it's really not. It depends on how you count it. But supposedly the problem is that once you get near full employment, people will be asking for a raise and demanding higher wages. And that actually did happen in the 1970s when we had inflation. But today, you don't see any wages aren't going up. So that is not a problem. That's not where the problem is. What is going up is all that money that's sloshing around in the speculative economy. And that money is not going to be drawn out by higher interest rates. In fact, it'll suck more money out of the economy because that's where the banks are and the big investors. And they're the ones that make money when interest rates go up. So.
Wow. Mark Armstrong?
That's right.
Mark Armstrong. Yeah, I always defer to Ellen when it comes to macroeconomic type analysis. And yes, I think what she's essentially saying is there's a gravitational pull by the 1%ers as well as their money so that they get what they need. But, you know, many people, middle class and others, are disenfranchised. We don't necessarily get higher wages. We don't necessarily benefit from the real estate bubble. There's a long list there, and the Fed's not really paying attention to that.
Well, I'm astonished that they did it right now. I mean,
the Federal Reserve is composed of 12. I mean, the Federal Open Market Committee that sets interest rates. They make their decisions behind closed doors. They're composed of 12 members. So 7 are from the Federal Reserve Board, and 5 are are presidents of Federal Reserve banks. All the Federal Reserve banks are 100% owned by the banks in their district. And right now, I think we're up to, is it 3 or, anyway, I think there's still 4 vacancies on the Federal Reserve Board, or is it 3? Anyway, the bankers have a majority. So even though you hear researchers, you know, Federal Reserve researchers say it's dangerous to be raising rates, we shouldn't be raising rates, they're raising them anyway, I would guess, because behind closed doors, the bankers, the heads of the Federal Reserve banks, are saying it's good for the banks to raise rates, so up they go. And, you know, there's this whole investor class that's expecting a return to normalcy. And the Fed did promise that this was only temporary when they did $4 trillion worth of quantitative easing and dropped rates to zero. So everybody expects them to raise rates. But the people who have bought cars and houses, et cetera, they weren't told that rates were going to go up. And, I mean, even businesses, they may know that rates are going to go up, but what choice do they have? They fund their businesses on a credit line, and they have to deal with whatever rate they get.
Harvey, I'd like to weigh in.
Unbelievable.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I mean, as someone who worked in the Congress for 13 years, you know, worked with the Federal Reserve, I find it very interesting that 4 weeks before an election, there's, you know, a rise in interest rates. Well, if the 1% get more money, they certainly can contribute to the Republican Party, correct? If they have more money to donate, that's the very, very cynical side of me. But then I'm a very cynical person, having worked in government my whole career. You know, number two, the 4% unemployment rate being full employment is a Eurocentric, you know, kind of a white male statistic, because just do the math. What's 4% of 320 million people? A hell of a lot of unemployed folks. So it's unconscionable and immoral to raise interest rates. They say we're at 3.5% unemployment. I don't believe that. Where I live in North Carolina, in Charlotte, in the black community, between the ages of 18 and 35, we have a 50% unemployment rate. If you're in New Mexico and you're Native American and Hispanic, you have a 50% unemployment rate. And many of the people who are working, especially in the South, are working 2 to 3 jobs. So these phony baloney statistics about unemployment are nothing but, you know, the comfortable class and the ruling class making up a garbage statistic. This is not the time. They should keep interest rates low so you can build more capacity and hire more people. It's just going to shut down the possibilities of people, especially of color, and folks who need full-time work having the ability to do so. But, you know, even progressives are often, and liberals, I have this battle all the time. I wrote a bill with Congress called H.R. 1000, which is a jobs for all bill written with several other economists, where some of the most progressive economists in Washington, D.C. are saying 4% is full employment. How about jobs for all? And a federal guarantee of work. We need to go back to the New Deal and the WPA. If you want a job, you should be able to get a job. That should be what that should be the discussion of what progressives talk about. When are we going back to a New Deal so everyone who wants a job gets a job, which is what Alejandro Cortez is running on in New York in Congress?
Okay, so now, Mark and Ellen, public banking should be an avenue towards full employment. And you have devoted a good part of your lives to public banking. We have now here in Los Angeles a vote on setting up a public bank. And thank you for that, Joel. How will public banking fit into the general scheme of things now? And what are the prospects for getting this done in Los Angeles?
Mark, you want to go?
Okay, so just to be clear, the vote is simply for a green light for the city to put together a business plan, essentially to build consensus as to what a public bank would look like. And you know, there's quite a long process associated with not only the consensus building and the business plan, but also the review and acceptance of the business plan by the political establishment in L.A. as well as in L.A. County. Keep in mind that a public bank in the city of L.A. could possibly provide services throughout the L.A. County and elsewhere. So there's this consensus building, and then there's also the application to the Department of Business Oversight in Sacramento in order to obtain a charter, and then, of course, the Federal Reserve would need to issue a master account number. So there's quite a few steps before a public bank would be established. This Charter Amendment B is one of the very first steps, and it's a way to involve the larger community voters who are just beginning to be educated about this. It's exciting that it's a democratic approach to soliciting input. We hope it goes in favor of a public bank. If it doesn't, I think we can always come back. Certainly it's an educational process, and we're just on the front end of this here in L.A. County and the city of L.A.
All right, so what will the public bank actually do? Why do we want a public bank, Ellen or Mark?
Okay, well, the public bank, if we follow the Bank of North Dakota model, which is our one and only publicly owned bank for the last 100 years, we now have one in American Samoa, but that was just this year. So the model we have, the 100-year-old model, is the Bank of North Dakota. And they, by law, in North Dakota, all of the state's deposits are deposited in the bank. Does not compete with the local banks, but it actually partners with them. And, it doesn't have private shareholders sucking out profits. It doesn't pay bonuses, fees, commissions, et cetera. So it has a very efficient business model. And according to the Wall Street Journal in 2014, it is actually more profitable than J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, although it's not even trying to be profitable. Its mandate is to serve the community. So it acts sort of like a cooperative where the people are the owners and they share in the profits and they share in the benefits in the form of below market interest rates. So that's the model we would also recommend for Los Angeles. In fact, what we're suggesting to start with is to just pool their resources. They send billions of dollars off to Wall Street every year. And then Wall Street doesn't return the favor by reinvesting that money in our community. So if we kept the money here, we could do like the Bank of North Dakota, leverage it into loan credit for the local community, which would, of course, help businesses, create jobs. I mean, there are various ways, what things you could do with it. What we would suggest to start out with is to simply refinance the city's own debt, because it's perfectly safe. I mean, nobody can say, oh, you're making risky loans to subprime businesses or something like that. We're making a loan to ourselves, and we were going to pay that debt off anyway. Now we're just going to pay it at a lower interest rate, and you can actually save billions of dollars just by trimming 1% off the interest rate over a bond issue that's supposed to stretch over 40 years. You know, it's just like a mortgage. If you over 30 years, you're going to pay as much in interest as you pay in principal. So anyway, that's what we suggest, something very conservative to start with to prove the model. And then when people trust the bank and they see that it's not politicians manipulating it for their own purposes, then it could use its profits to, well, first of all, it can use the profits, what it saves in interest, it can use for all those things that are needed in Los Angeles, such as affordable housing, solar energy, that kind of thing. And when it builds up a capital base, then it can start making loans more directly into the community. So basically following the North Dakota model.
Who makes the decisions? Who runs the public bank? How is there a board of directors that's chosen by the public? How does that happen?
Mark, you want to say?
Yeah, there would be a board of directors. It would be similar to a JPA or an independent organization set up by public government. So, you know,
what's a JPA, Mark, wait, what is a JPA? What is a JPA?
Joint Powers Authority. They're very common.
You guys are very deeply, far more knowledgeable than me about, or Joel probably, about this stuff. So please don't use acronyms, because I have no idea what a JPA was, although I'm sure 99% of people do. So go ahead, though. This is a critical key. Who runs these banks?
Right. So what happens with when local governments have a significant opportunity, and a good example is community choice energy. When that legislation was passed 10 or so years ago, I think it was more than that, frankly. The opportunity was to create energy companies that served as brokers and then got into the production business. And so you had Marin Clean Power and Sonoma Clean Power created. And I think there's another one down in Los Angeles that was recently created. And these are all JPAs, or Joint Powers Authorities, which are in the business of brokering energy and steering energy production as well as consumption towards clean energy as much as possible. So that's the overall purpose of these third party entities, which are essentially government owned. And the same idea would apply with a public bank. You allow for a corporation or a JPA to be created, which has a banking license. And because of that banking license or charter, it has the ability to create credit at a very low cost, as Ellen was saying, and that credit can be used to refinance municipal bonds, as well as for a multiple of other programs, whether it's affordable housing or renewable energy production or a number of different things where that credit could be applied for the benefit of the people in that particular economy. And so the governing board of that corporation or JPA or Joint Powers Authority is really important, as what you're getting at. And those decisions are critical. Those policy decisions are critical. So you probably have a mixture of some elected politicians who have some influence on that board. But more importantly, you probably have direct representatives of the people, as well as business folks. It would be a fairly large board, I would imagine. In Germany, they have 15-member boards. And the purpose of them is to resolve critical issues at the board level, and so that good policy that is rooted in addressing specific issues comes from the board. It would not be in Germany, the Sparkassen banks, the public banks in Germany, they do not have advisory boards which advise to the governing board. You can say even that the people who would have been on the advisory boards are part of the governing board. including employees of those public banks, and they all have a say as to what the direction and overall policy of the bank should be. So the public bank in the city of L.A. Would be hopefully democratically elected, as well as reflect the diversity that's here in the city of L.A.
Alan?
Yeah, no, I agree with Mark. I defer to Mark in this. Those matters.
So you would have, well, let's talk about time frame here. If this passes on the November ballot in Los Angeles, mandating a public bank be established, how long will it be before the bank is actually established?
I'll defer to Mark.
Probably about 2 years.
2 years. Now, would you have? Are there any? Are there any kind? That's a minimum 2 years. Are there any kinds of banking institutions in place now that could fulfill some of the functions of the public bank?
Well, there
Harvey,
is
what's your
a
question
proposal
again?
That
Are there any what?
Made by someone who is retained by Act LA to have a pre-bank situation where you would actually take the deposits, the city's deposits, and put them in this entity, and it could act like a bank where it could return those funds in one day, just like you would with a depository with a deposit account. But they would be called loans rather than deposits, and then you would still have a pool of money that you could use for city purposes. There's some things you wouldn't be able to do with it, but if you could get your whole setup for taking deposits, paying payroll, all that kind of stuff. So that's a possibility.
Mark? So you're saying that in the interim, there are institutions? Well, for example, let's say the city council said, okay, we're going to have a public bank in 2 years or so, but in the meantime, where can they take their money out of a major commercial bank and put it to save all the fees?
Yeah, that's the point. They could do that. They could put that in their own entity. It wouldn't necessarily be able to leverage that money into commercial loans, although it might be able to use it internally, but they could get the whole set up going, sort of like we used to have a postal banking system from 1911 to 1967. They weren't allowed to make loans like mortgages, but they took in people's deposits, and you could do check cashing. You could do basic banking services through that system.
And a city could do that. How much, for example, the city of Los Angeles, how much does the city of Los Angeles spend a year in fees for its banking?
$170 million. Yeah,
$170 million a
right.
year.
The amount of interest
banking?
Is $1.1 billion.
What?
Yep, $200 million just in fees. It was $300 million in 2014, and even then, they didn't know that they'd gotten all the fees. If you count pension funds, they deduct money without even reporting it. It's money that they allege they are owed for making a certain percentage on the investment. So these fees are hidden. We've got over 100 accounts, apparently, and even the treasurer doesn't know what they're paying for everything. So that's another reason
they
for bringing it home.
Who
so
do
we
they bank
keep track with? Of it.
Who does it? Where is the city of Los Angeles? Where is its money?
Its transaction accounts, or its, you know, deposit account that it for everyday purposes is with Wells Fargo. So the city council voted to divest from Wells Fargo. That was from what motivated them was this same very active local group that you saw last Sunday. So they persuaded the city council to divest for sort of on moral grounds. And then the question is, where do you put the money? And that's how they got on this public banking kick. But they do.
But where is the money now?
But
where's the money
with Wells Fargo? Because they have to put it out to bid for another bank. It would be nice if we could jump right in with the public bank, but I suspect it would go to some other bank first.
Well, are there community banks that could handle this money for lesser fees?
Apparently not. They don't really want the money because they have to pay they have to collateralize it with 110% collateral, which means if you take in $1 million, you have to come up with $1.1 million in something like federal bonds. You have to buy something with it, something very short term and liquid. So they don't really make money off it. I don't know, Mark.
For the $170 million in fees, we could solve the homeless crisis, right?
Exactly. There are many things, and there was an article in 2014. It was a whole study done by SEIU showing that was more money than we paid to fix up our roads. We could solve our transportation problems.
And this gets to the heart of the value behind a public bank. It turns what was an expense into an income stream. So you're essentially paying yourself the fees as well as the interest. You disenfranchise, you get rid of the middleman, which is Wall Street, and you basically have this separate entity, which is owned by the city, be responsible for creating credit, using many billions of dollars from the taxpayers, and using that to create credit and make loan programs that reflect the values of those taxpayers. Right now, the city treasurer and state treasurer, for that matter, they collect all the money and then it deposited into Wall Street banks, and then those banks use that public credit to invest in coal-fired plants in Chile or, you know, elsewhere across the world. And so you don't benefit from the credit that comes from these really precious deposits, which are public funds. And so it brings it all home. It allows for the loan programs to be created democratically with a intent to reflect the values of the people in this immediate area. And it allows for people to invest local.
Well, why? So this is going to take 2 years or more. And in the meantime, the city loses $170 million a year. Isn't there a way to do this quicker?
Well,
it depends on leadership.
I would agree. They should set up their own facility, and they could take the money and just do simple banking without doing loans, big loans. But it's up to the city council what they decide to do.
Well, I'm all for the public bank, and I certainly hope the referendum passes, but $170 million a year, if we wait 2 or 3 years, you're talking $500 billion.
Yep.
Agreed. which could solve the homeless
half
crisis,
a billion
anyway.
Yeah, half a billion.
I'm gonna bet that this thing is gonna pass, but I'm gonna also bet that the Wall Streeters will come in and confuse, do as much confusion and stalling as possible to drag out the process of creating a public bank.
I've been quite impressed with the city council. Herb Wesson has stood up to his own advisors on these things. There was an article in the LA Times where they were listing, I guess a legal counsel was supposed to tell them what kind of hurdles they were going to have to jump to have a bank, and they said, well, there's this problem and that problem, and they were kind of discouraging the city council from doing it. And Herb Wesson said, we'll decide if we're going to have a bank. We just want you to tell us how to do it. So they seem to have the political will, which I think is great, because, we've had a lot of these bills that are that die in committee or whatever, because you don't have people behind them that are really committed to the cause. But I think this city council president is committed and will push forward.
Well, let's hope. I hope you're pushing. So what is the number? Or it's a letter, right? It's Proposition B. Is that right?
Charter Amendment B. So it's not even a referendum. It's actually an initiative or a measure filed by the city council itself. We didn't do it. The city council put it on of its own volition. So we really didn't have very much time to respond to it. That's the problem. We've got no funding behind this push to get it passed. Fortunately,
is there an opposition?
The other side hasn't put money behind it either so far, but we saw that they're talking about it, the bank.
Wow. All right. Mark Armstrong, what do you think the chances are of this thing passing?
Well, it's really hard to say because it is fairly new to the voters, to many of the voters, and so this will be the first time they've heard of a municipally owned bank, and there's no polling that we've done to determine whether or not to determine how people would vote on this, and so it's really an unknown. At the very least, this will be a baseline. So that we'll all know what we need to do in order to be successful next time round if we don't indeed win it. But I'm expecting that people will, well, certainly I expect, because this was endorsed by, it's over 100 different groups at this point, including the Los Angeles Democratic Party. What I'm expecting is for there to be a number of people who will vote yes because of the knowledge that they've gotten from these different clubs and other organizations. And then there'll be a large number of folks, I think, who may just not vote. Ellen was saying the other day how, this may be too intimidating for some people, and they just declined to vote at all because they don't know much about it. So hopefully...
Well, how do people find out? Give us before we lose time here, how do people find out about this? Oh, God. What's the website, real quick?
PublicBankLA.com.
PublicBankLA.com, folks. You in Los Angeles. Thank you, Joel Siegel, Mark Armstrong, and Ellen Brown. See you next week in Solartopia.
Solartopia, don't you know we're going to have a Solartopia all over.